Our Unitarian Universalist principles set a high bar, the inherent worth and dignity of every person. The goal of world community with peace, liberty, and justice for all. Respect for the interdependent web of all existence. And one of the reasons that we have such high goals is that many of our theological ancestors had a highly optimistic view of human nature and human potential, whereas some theological conservatives that they were defining themselves against had a very pessimistic view of human nature, original sin, total depravity. And Unitarians and Universalists, in contrast, had hope in humanity coming together to build a better world. And one influential example is from 1886. The Unitarian minister then, James Freeman Clark, wrote something called 5 Points of a New Theology. And he wrote that as an intentional 5 points to contrast it with the 5 points of Calvinism. We looked at that some last week. And Clark summarized Unitarianism then in the late 19th century as about the fatherhood of God. Now keep in mind, this is before the 1970s and sexist language, right? So, and awareness of that. So the fatherhood of God, we're all one human family under the fatherhood of God. The brotherhood of man, right? John Lennon. We're all related. The parent, and then we're all brothers and sisters. The leadership of Jesus, Unitarianism at that point was still very much Christian-centric in many ways. Salvation by character, so it's not salvation by God doing something, it's salvation by the character that we develop and our freedom and responsibility. And the progress of mankind onward and upward forever. You can particularly see the optimism in that final point, the progress of mankind onward and upward forever. It's just going to keep getting better. Likewise, 2 weeks ago, we learned about some about Theodore Parker, that abolitionist Unitarian minister who was one of the Secret Six that helped fund John Brown's raid on Harper's Ferry. In a similarly optimistic vein, in 1853, Parker said, "I don't pretend to understand the moral universe. The arc is a long one, but from what I see, I am sure that it bends toward justice." MLK later borrowed that phrase from Parker 100 years later. But that 19th century optimism, the progress of mankind onward and upward forever, the arc of the universe bends toward justice, is much more difficult to maintain today in the 21st century. A major reason is that Clark and Parker and our other optimistic 19th century ancestors had no way of predicting the world-altering events that would come and shape the 20th century. We've been focusing a lot on history the past few weeks. For any of you who are not historically inclined, I promise I will shift gears next week, and we're going to talk about comparative religions. But I feel it's important to recognize and reflect on that we have just passed the 100th anniversary of the assassination of Archduke Franz Ferdinand that helped trigger the beginning of World War I. Various centenary commemorations will likely continue over the next 4 years, which will be marking things all the way through November 11th, 2018, which will mark the 100th anniversary of the armistice that ended the First World War. And if this sermon leaves you curious to learn more, I see Doug Ford out in the audience, one of our historians. And at 10 a.m. in the Friendly Forum on August 31st, he's going to lead a book, a discussion about Barbara Tuchman's 1962 Pulitzer Prize-winning classic, The Guns of August. How many of you have read that book? Okay, quite a few. It's about the outbreak of World War I, that first month, and it's been called by the Modern Library one of the 100 best nonfiction books of all time. But I'll leave The Guns of August to Doug, the professional historian. Instead, I want to trace some of the journey from 19th century theological optimism about human nature and the inevitability of progress through the crucible of the 20th century, starting especially with World War I, to the implications of where we find ourselves today as early 21st century Unitarian Universalists. I'll be drawing especially on Philip Jenkins's recent book, The Great and Holy War, How World War I Became a Religious Crusade. And consider the difference between the 19th century assertion, again, the progress of mankind, onward and upward forever, and the arc of the universe sort of inevitably bends towards justice, compared to the first stanza of William Butler Yeats's poem, The Second Coming, written in 1919, immediately after the end of World War I. Instead of inevitable optimism, we get turning and turning in the widening gyre. The falcon cannot hear the falconer. Things fall apart. The center cannot hold. Mere anarchy is loosed upon the world. The blood-dimmed tide is loosed, and everywhere the ceremony of innocence is drowned. The best lack all conviction, and the worst are full of passionate intensity. And there's a strong argument to be made that the turn from modernity to postmodernity, where we find ourselves today, began with the global trauma of the First World War. The move from a trust in one grand narrative of progress to a much more fragmented and fractured worldview of many competing and even contradictory worldviews about how the world is and how the world should be. No longer could we members of Western civilization pretend that modern technology and increasing global intercommunication and connection was going to inevitably unite us under the fatherhood of God, the brotherhood of man, the leadership of Jesus, salvation by character, and the progress of mankind onward and upward forever. You can hear people like in the 19th century sort of repeating that as like, you know, we're all going to get behind that, and it's not what happened. Instead of the universe bending towards justice, science tells us that the universe ultimately tends toward entropy, toward disorder, as in Yeats's poem, the falcon cannot hear the falconer, the center cannot hold. The First World War changed everything about the realization of how much devastation we could wreak on ourselves as a species on a global scale. And as we know now, the 20th century was just getting started. From the perspective of 100 years later, many historians look back on World War I as about narrow national rivalries and selfish imperial interests. Indeed, Harry Patch, the last soldier actually to have fought in the war's trenches, he died in 2009 at the age of 111, said, quote, two civilized nations, British and German, fighting for our lives, what the hell we fought for, I now don't know. Patch continued, the politicians who took us to war should have been given the guns and told to settle the differences themselves instead of organizing nothing better than legalized mass murder. Those are hard words, but modern technology, machine guns, chemical warfare, tanks, made the First World War different and deadly on a previously unforeseen scale. Looking only at soldiers, the overall casualties were approximately 10 million. But we can look even to a single day, August 22nd, 1914, barely a month after the first shots were fired, during that period that Tuchman traces in the Guns of August, when 27,000 French soldiers lost their lives in one day. 27,000. At the same time, there are other sides to the story, such as the famous Christmas Truce, some of you may know about, in 1914, in which British and German soldiers came out of the trenches, of their respective trenches, to fraternize, to drink, to even play friendly games of soccer. But it's no coincidence that that Christmas Truce happened in the first Christmas to come after the start of the war. The longer the battle continued, and there were many reasons that I won't get into why people had no idea the war would last 4 years, that every indication would it would be much shorter. But the longer the battle continued, the more entrenched and jaded soldiers understandably become, making events like the Christmas Truce increasingly impossible. And as we've explored in previous weeks, delegates to the annual Unitarian Conference in 1917, in the months after the U.S. entered the war, voted overwhelmingly to support the war efforts on top of a very small handful of protests. And in contrast, by far the most significant center of Christian anti-war activism during the First World War came out of the Vatican. With the Pope regularly calling for peace and even offering compelling proposals, some of which were very similar to how the war actually ended throughout the war of how we might end before 4 years were up. And part of why I wanted to reflect on the First World War this morning was to explore some of the ways that religion got mixed up into war propaganda, some of it just as a cautionary tale for the future. Historical records show that with startling literalism, visual representations, we have records of these today, you can Google image them, and all the main participant nations had these visual images of Christ himself on the battle lines, on their side, of course, right? Whether in films and posters and postcards, Jesus blessed German soldiers going into battle, Jesus comforted the dying victims of German atrocities, Jesus personally led a reluctant Kaiser to confront the consequences of his evil policies. We similarly have records of religious leaders infusing religiosity into the war effort. An Episcopal rector here in Washington, D.C. said, "It is God who has summoned us to this war. The conflict is a crusade, the greatest in history, the holiest." Likewise, a liberal congregational minister published an article about the Christian duty to hate. The Christian duty to hate Imperial Germany and all its works. A liberal Unitarian, Albert Diefenbach, said, "There is not an opportunity to deal death to the enemy that Jesus himself would shirk from or delay in seizing. Jesus would take the bayonet, the bomb, the grenade, and the rifle." End quote. I bring up these examples in part to contrast them with what followed, of how we're different as a people as a result of World War I. It's very interesting that, as Jenkins writes, World War II produced no overtly religious manifestations, even vaguely comparable to those that I just mentioned in the first. It's very difficult to find propaganda imagery depicting supernatural intervention on the battlefield that was commonplace a generation earlier. What changed was the disillusionment following the First World War. Influenced by books such as the Schofield Reference Bible, who knows what I'm talking about, the Schofield Reference Bible, so it's keyed to sort of the Second Coming and apocalyptic scenarios, so very influential in conservative communities. Many conservative religious leaders saw signs of the apocalypse in the First World War, partially as a result of the Schofield Reference Bible, that they thought presaged the Second Coming of Jesus. Jenkins traces the height of these apocalyptic hopes to late 1917, when headlines were reporting, I mean, think about what it must have been like. Headlines were reporting the Russian Revolution, the apparitions of the Virgin Mary at Fatima in Portugal, this is all at the same time, and British General Sir Edmund Allenby entering Jerusalem and winning battles at places like Megiddo, right? And headlines read, if you go back and look them up, the world's media commonly referred to that battle as Armageddon, because, you know, related to the book of Revelation. But as Jenkins writes, of course, those millenarian hopes never materialized. By 1918, surrounded by the legions of the bereaved and the millions of maimed, it then seemed blasphemous to speak about World War I as bringing in the kingdom of God or living in the end times. And I'm not even getting into the Spanish flu pandemic, which started during the last years of World War I and killed at least five times as many people as the war. Five times as many. There is, of course, so much more to say about the First World War and much more that I'm sure will be explored in various ways over the next four centenary years. But as I move toward my conclusion, I want to make three important points from Jenkins about that are clear now, 100 years later, about how our world, especially our religious landscape, has changed as a result of World War I. The first is that before World War I, Europe was much more the center of global Christianity. Even more significantly, events like the Armenian Genocide that killed many Armenian Orthodox Christians, as well as the Russian Revolution, which drastically affected the Orthodox Christians, the Russian Orthodox Christians, who previously accounted for a quarter of the world's Christians. From the perspective of 100 years later, we can see that in 1914, the year World War I began, the Orthodox outnumbered Pentecostal and Charismatic Christians by better than 100-1. Today, Pentecostal Charismatic believers outnumber the Orthodox 3-1. That's not to say anything good or bad about Pentecostalism. It's just to show the shift of how Orthodoxy has lost dominance. And Jenkins writes, by 2030 at the latest, Africa will be the world's largest Christian continent, and most of its major churches will to some degree trace their origins to the spiritual explosion of the World War I years. Second, 100 years later, we can see that the end of the Ottoman Empire in the aftermath of World War I, with its effective end of the Islamic Caliphate, has radically changed Islam. In Jenkins' words, as a political force, Islam in 1914 was inconceivably weaker than it is 100 years later today. There were perhaps, in 1914, 240 million Muslims in the world, so that Christians outnumbered Muslims by 2.5 to 1, compared to a modern ratio of about 1.5. The number of Muslims alive in 1914 was not much larger than the modern Muslim population of just the nation of Indonesia. I'll pick up there in a sermon in October about the future of Islam and the dynamics affecting it. For now, point three, World War I tremendously affected Judaism as well. In 1900, Europe was home to 80% of the world's Jews. Today, over 80% are located in just two countries, Israel and the United States. The war accelerated trends that were already in progress. And of course, the conflict in Palestine today cannot be understood without the 1917 Balfour Declaration from the British supporting the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people. In 1860, Palestine had perhaps 7,000 Jews, rising to 60,000 by 1914, but the growth was then dramatic. Between 1919, so right after World War I, and 1930, 120,000 Jews arrived, with a peak immigration in 1925. The Jewish share of the population grew from perhaps 5% in 1880 to 16% in 1931, and that was before the Nazis seized power in Germany. By 1948, the Jewish population was 650,000. Our religious landscape has changed so much from World War I globally. Before World War I, the Middle East had significantly larger Christian populations, and that matters, right? When you live beside each other, it's different. It creates a cosmopolitanism at its best. And Europe had many more Jews. After World War I, Jenkins shows that from a religious perspective, the world underwent what we could call a great simplification, in which a mainly Muslim Middle East now stands against a Europe defined by its Christian heritage and a Christianity that scarcely acknowledges its lost Middle East dimension. With all that being said, and with all we know 100 years later about after the start of World War I, I will tell you that I still believe in setting our sights high on that high bar that our UU7 principles call us to. The inherent worth and dignity of every person. The goal of world community with peace, liberty, justice for all, and the interdependent web of all existence, that what we do affects every other person. But the lessons of the First World War challenge us that reaching those worthy goals is by no means inevitable. History doesn't bend towards justice. Peace with justice will only come if we humans freely choose the things that make for peace and justice. In the words of Dr. King, we must learn to live together and care about each other, all of us, as brother and sister, or we will perish together as fools.